Well, as I've mentioned previously, I spent some time overseas in Malaysia when I was younger, living with my family. And my parents tell me that one day they were approached by a Malaysian police officer who simply said, "We have been watching you." And those few words would potentially make you consider returning home. What was the intention? To create fear, perhaps? To remind us that this wasn't our home? In Malaysia, our family were strangers in a strange land. And perhaps you felt like that as well as you've travelled overseas. Perhaps you're a citizen of another country, and in Australia you feel like a stranger in a strange land. Well, the term strangers or sojourners or exiles is often used to describe God's people. And as Christians, we are often reminded that we aren't at our true home yet, are we? And the term strangers in a strange land certainly applies to the Israelites living under the Persian rule, the likes of Esther and Mordecai. It was an empire that didn't come under God's rule, and it was at the mercy of the ruling king. Well, if you know the timeline of events, in 587 BC, the final siege of Jerusalem began. God had brought the ferocious Babylonians in the north down to the southern kingdom of Israel. It was an active judgment against their rebellion and idolatry. And the Babylonians took many of the best and brightest back to Babylon. The book of Daniel recounts the story of the first Israelites who lived in exile in Babylon under King Nebuchadnezzar. Well, Nebuchadnezzar died in 562 AD, and after which the Babylonian Empire rapidly declined. But the empire next door began to rise, that of Persia under the king Cyrus. Mervyn Brenneman writes, "Babylon had reason to fear the growing empire to the north. Cyrus quickly marched across the upper Mesopotamia, conquering Armenia, Cappadocia, and Cilicia. Cyrus defeated Croesus in 547, which allowed him to gain control over the Greek cities in Asia Minor. He then conquered more territory in the east, into what is now Afghanistan. So the Persian Empire reached from here to the western shores of Asia Minor. It was only a matter of time before Cyrus would take over Babylon. In 539, Cyrus ordered Gobryas, one of his officials, to attack the city Babylon, was quickly taken. If you remember back to your history classes, you might even recall that this event's recorded on what's called the Cyrus Cylinder. It reminds us that what's happening here is not simply fantasy, but grounded in history. The Persian Empire was now in charge. And this is the context in which Esther finds its meaning. The book is about a group of Israelites who, about 50 or 60 years after being allowed to return to Jerusalem, still found themselves in the Persian Empire. The Persians held the power. The Israelites had none. And those in power couldn't always be trusted to do the right thing. The property or even the lives of the Israelites could be taken away at any moment. God's people have always had challenges, haven't they? And the temptation, perhaps, in this situation or our situation would be to keep your head low, your mouth shut, blend in, lest you bring upon yourself the wrath of the empire. Don't be a tall poppy, as it were. But is that the right way for God's people to live? After all, Esther believed there was a God in heaven, a God who had committed himself in the Old Testament to the Israelites. Did God still care about his family that was still in Persia? Did God still have what it takes to reach out and intervene on their behalf? When we consider it in those terms, it becomes clear that the situation of Esther is not so different from our own. I imagine that you know very well the experience of being strangers in a strange land, being in a world but not of the world. We are citizens of our country of birth, yet we are profoundly subjects of a greater king, with significantly different loyalties and priorities and principles. And sometimes those differences aren't very noticeable. Other times it's painfully obvious that we're not operating under the same marching orders as the world around us. We've been reminded of recent years as the secular ethic drifts apart from the Christian ethic in areas such as marriage and gender and abortion and euthanasia. It can be tough standing for Jesus while living in a culture that wants us to keep quiet. It's not easy, but like Esther and Daniel, this is the home that we find ourselves in. It can be even tougher for those of us who are far removed from the stories of the Bible. Unlike the Israelites coming out of Egypt, we don't get to experience the parting of the Red Sea and the terrible plagues that happened. And unlike the disciples, we don't get to witness firsthand the teaching and the miracles of Jesus. Sometimes God's power and God's love and God's care and God's intervention seems particularly distant. And perhaps you've had dreams to be married or to have a certain job or a certain direction in life, and maybe it was a certain health issue. And in these matters, God seemed silent or distant. Well, God certainly seems silent in the book of Esther. These are some of the difficulties that Esther faced. God was hidden from view, invisible, but the empire around her was certainly visible. Esther would have constantly reminded about the Persian Empire everywhere she looked. She would have seen it in the marching of the soldiers, the thunder of the chariots. She would see it in the display of the king's wealth. Perhaps she would have smelled it in the incense of the temples around her. For Esther, it would have been easy to give up her trust in God and to give into the crowd. For those one or two sci-fi fans like me, you would know the enemy from Star Trek, the Borg, who had as their mantra, "Resistance is futile, you must be assimilated." In the same way, the Persian Empire endeavored to bring into submission the various people groups that they had conquered as well. And what made it more difficult for the Israelites at this time was that many of the God-fearing Israelites among these exiles had already turned home under the rule of Cyrus. And he permitted that in 538 BC. And all those who were passionate to return back to Jerusalem, back to Israel, would have already left. And now, more than 50 years after that event, the temptation of the remaining Israelites would be to settle in and get comfortable. Those who remained, it must have been because exile had been kind to them. But they forgot that the Persian king could turn against them at any moment. So assimilation was one temptation. Keep your head down, your mouth shut, and don't say anything. Even when it contradicts the marching orders given to us by God. It's a temptation for Esther, a temptation for us. If assimilation didn't get the better of the Israelites, then perhaps despair would. They were surrounded by a powerful, controlling empire that could turn against them in an instant. It reminds us of our brothers and sisters in countries like China who constantly have the experience and the crackdowns of the governments and the disappearances. Certainly a reason for despair in those situations, especially when the God we serve acts in profoundly mysterious ways. God's sovereign plan doesn't usually include lightning strike to our enemies on the spot. Often, God's people need to remain patient and sometimes suffer as we wait to see the hand of God at work. Well, how could these exiles remain faithful in this situation, in the midst of the Persian Empire? Well, the book of Esther provides two ways. The first approach is that a number of the commentaries highlight is that it satirizes the empire. It's with satire. Perhaps you would have heard some of that as you heard Justin read and you heard the disagreement between the husband and the wife. The only one that has true power, absolute power, is the God we serve. And God will make a mockery of all powers that set themselves up against him. Ian Duguid writes, "The book of Esther shows us that great empire is not run by fearsome giants at all, but by petty bureaucrats. We don't need to fear this power after all." And the second approach that this book helps to comfort God's people is to show us that God often works in ways other than that of, say, the Exodus from Israel. There we see God's hand visibly at work in terrible plagues and thunder and lightning, the parting of the Red Sea, dramatic events. In the book of Esther, however, we see that God is actively at work, though in less evident ways, quietly directing the affairs of men and women according to his sovereign plan. There's no thunder or lightning here, no great heroes. There's not even a mention of God's name in this book. But we do see God's providence at work, moving ordinary people into the right places at just the right times. It reminds us that if we expect God to only act in miraculous ways, we'll overlook the majority of what he's actually doing in our lives. The empires of this world, along with their power and control, are no match for the ordinary work of God. There will only be one victor in the end. Well, at the start of this book, we introduce to the Persian king Ahasuerus, or if you have NIV or another one, the Greek translation is Xerxes. Ahasuerus is a pretty big deal. We read that he ruled 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. And what is more, he knows how to throw a party. This is no Saturday afternoon event, but 180 days. That's 6 months of displaying the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness. No expense was spared. There were marble pillars, white and violet hangings, couches of gold and silver, mosaic pavements made of fine resources. Are you impressed? And you're meant to read this, and you're meant to be impressed. It paints for us an incredible picture of wealth and power, but one that would be fit for today's elite. We're meant to be oppressed and perhaps a little bit revolted at this much excess, all to the display and glory of King Ahasuerus. But even amongst this display, we begin to see hints of his weakness. In verse 8, drinking was according to this edict. There is no compulsion, for the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired. It tells us that, yes, when it comes to parties, Ahasuerus was very generous. But isn't it strange that the king feels the need to issue a royal edict telling people to do as they please? And the commentators pick up on this. The king has so much power, he's begun regulating every aspect of people's lives. This is petty bureaucracy. Real power isn't found in regulating every aspect. That's usually a sign of weakness, and we'll see that in a moment, that you can't stand the thought of people living their own lives, so you have to control them. This was the rule and reign of King Ahasuerus. A king so powerful, he felt the need to tell people to drink or not to drink. Either way, it's under the law. Well, you may think that that might be a bit nitpicky there, this king and his need for power, but you can't ignore his control in the next few verses and seeing the way he deals with Queen Vashti. Verse 10, the king had been drinking for 7 days straight and was now merry with wine. In a usual display of his overkill and excess, he sends no fewer than those 7 eunuchs that were hard to pronounce to summon the queen, to come before the party guests wearing her royal crown in verse 11, in order to show the people and the princesses her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. Now, some of the early rabbis who comment on this verse suggested that the king wanted the queen to appear only in her royal crown. And while this might be reading too much into these verses, it's not far off the mark of the king's intention. The queen would have received this summons with great offense, having received it from her drunken husband. What woman wants to come before a group of drunken men to entertain their pleasure? Ian Duguid puts it in today's terms: to command his wife to appear dressed up in royal finery for the enjoyment of a crowd of drunken men was to treat her as a doll, a mere object who existed for the king's pleasure and to show off his power, a trophy wife. The true character of this king is being revealed even further. And how did Vashti respond? Verse 12. The queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. Sorry, just let me get this sorted out. At this, the king became enraged and his anger burned within him. The king has been humiliated at his own party in front of the leaders of his empire. Ahasuerus could make laws dictating drinking, but his laws could not ultimately compel what his people would do, what his wife would do. He couldn't compel his wife to be treated as an object of pleasure. The queen said no, and the empire was powerless to enforce the will of a king. What should the king do? You would think that in matters of personal disagreement, that a more personal or tender or groveling approach would be needed towards his wife. But no, instead of making amends with Vashti, King Ahasuerus summons the wise men. It shows us there were legal ramifications involved in this. The commands of the king were law. Karen Jobes writes, "It's unlikely that there was a legal precedent on the books stating what must be done in this specific situation. Apparently, no queen was yet to defy the king, probably because no king had yet outmatched the thoughtless request of the drunken king Ahasuerus. A conference of wise men was required to work through this dangerous threat to authority. The advisors were concerned with this just say no policy, that this would spread throughout the empire. Verse 17 onwards, "For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt. Since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she didn't come. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will will say the same to all the king's officials, and there'll be content and wrath in plenty. What would happen in ordinary homes to the man's position of authority when Persian women learned the Queen Vashti had refused her husband? Joyce Baldwin writes, "The thought of female jokes and gossip at a man's expense provided sufficient incentive for a new royal decree. And this decree would intimidate any wives who dared to defy their husbands." Well, did Vashti achieve anything? She lost her position and power and importance as queen. In verse 19 and 20 we write, "If it pleases the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, that it may be not be repelled, that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she." So when the decree was made by the king and proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it is vast, all women will give honour to their husbands, high and low alike. Ironically, Vashti received what she wanted, not to have to go before the king ever again. But although Vashti was silent, we've been given enough insight to see the character of this king. Vashti was a woman of conviction. She wouldn't give in to the whims of her husband. Her husband, on the other hand, was a drunk who couldn't even maintain the respect of his wife. The only means of authority he had was to perpetually make new laws to command behaviour. But these laws were powerless to compel anyone to act in any type of way. The king failed to learn this lesson. He busily set about making another law that he would be powerless to enforce in verse 20. "All women will give honour to their husbands, high and low alike." This advice pleased the king and the prince, and the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, that every man be master in his own household and speak according to the language of his people. So significant resources went into spreading this law, this edict. Women must not imitate Vashti. What result did the king hope to achieve? Did the king and his advisors feel that the social order of the empire was at stake? Did the king expect instant obedience from all women, even when their husbands were thoughtless and abusive? Should all men banish their wives if they failed to submit? One thing is certain. This letter would have made the whole empire aware of the troubles that the king was having. The king was unable to inspire even his own wife. Did he think that now he could inspire the men of the empire through a letter that detailed his ability to gain the respect of his wife? Surely this caused many Persian men to raise an eyebrow. The king lacked substance and character. He lacked good judgment. He failed to lead and inspire others. He hid behind the law and his advisors. This is the world in which God's people often find themselves in, and often continue to find themselves in, a world in which power is sometimes held by those lacking in good wisdom and judgment, and sometimes held by people who have no regard for God at all and who promote immoral positions. This world can be a confusing and strange place for God's people at times. It can be a dangerous place for God's people. Well, what do we learn from the first chapter of Esther as we journey through this life, this kingdom that we find ourselves in, as we journey to an even greater kingdom? Well, first, it reminds us not to take the power and the glory that is on the display too seriously. The chapter began with the king displaying his great wealth over a six-month party. How seriously do you take your own wealth and your own power? Your own self-importance. The world around us takes those things very seriously, emphasizing the opinions of celebrities, defining itself by how much stuff you can accumulate, spending excessive amounts on entertainment. It's hard to see a difference between the lifestyle of King Ahasuerus and the lifestyle of our modern world. Now, we don't live in the Persian Empire, do we? But we still live in a materialistic empire. It wants us to dream of a better life, full of more stuff, and then run after that dream. Ian Duguid writes, "It's easy for us to be dazzled by the empire's ostentatious or impressive show, but it's empty of real power at its center. The empire of this world is a glittering hologram that has no real substance." Now, early I said that the temptation would be to assimilate into this empire, settle in and get comfortable. And how do we defend ourselves from that? We do that by remembering that we are citizens of another kingdom, a greater kingdom, a far significantly value, more valuable than the one we are in. And Christians should see that quest for more stuff, for better stuff, as a fool's errand that's pointless. And to be quick to spot this pursuit in our own hearts. Perhaps if Jesus were to say something to King Ahasuerus, it would be, "What good is it for a man to gain gold and silver chairs, marble buildings, fine curtains, the best wine, the place of authority, and yet forfeit his soul?" It reminds us as individuals and as a church that we're not to use our finances and influence in a way that would distract people from knowing Jesus, but in a way that would declare to others that Jesus is the King and we're living for his kingdom. Second, this chapter reminds us that sometimes we have to wait to see what God's doing. God is nowhere to be seen in this chapter and not mentioned explicitly in the whole book at all. But just because we can't see God, it doesn't mean that he's not at work. God is very much active and alive in this book, arranging events and circumstances, working all things for the good of his people. The two main characters, Esther and Mordecai, haven't even entered the scene of this book yet. But in chapter 1, God is at work, arranging the circumstances that would give them the position of influence. Why did Vashti throw away her position of power? Why did King Ahasuerus make the dumb request to objectify the queen? Why would someone recommend that Vashti replaced with a better queen? These events, you would look at and say, these aren't miraculous. They could be explained away as a part of human life. Yet all of these events were necessary for Esther to take the stage. Are they coincidences? Absolutely not. This is the providential hand of God at work. The first chapter of Esther seems inconsequential to anything at all. The party of the king that thinks too highly of himself and too little of his wife. We have to wait for the whole story to be told to see what God is doing in this book. Perhaps it seems to you that God is silent, strangely absent from your life. And the encouragement here is that is far from the truth. If you trust in him, you can be assured that God is plotting the course of your life for your good and his glory. And more often than not, this story is worked out in the lives of faithful Christians in ordinary tasks and events. And third and finally, this passage reminds us that God's kingdom is not like the kingdoms of this world. Now, there's some superficial similarities here. God is a great king whose law cannot be challenged. Ahasuerus was making laws, wasn't he? His sovereignty governs all things. Ahasuerus believed he had some sovereignty. Yet unlike King Ahasuerus, who creates laws on a drunken whim, God's law is beneficial for everyone. God doesn't treat us in a way less than human like King Ahasuerus treated his wife, but cares for us deeply. God's kingdom doesn't grow with great displays of wealth and power like this party. The kingdom of God grows in often quite ordinary and slow ways. Bigger is not always better in God's kingdom. There's another point of comparison here in these two kingdoms. King Ahasuerus held a great banquet and called out his bride, Vashti. Why did he do that? To objectify her. When we read in Revelation 19 that there is a new kingdom, and there'll also be a great banquet there as well, the marriage supper of the Lamb. And at this meal, God doesn't call out his bride to put her to shame, but to display his grace and love to her. King Ahasuerus had to make commands that aimed Vashti to attend the feast. God, on the other hand, draws his bride, sinners, to himself as he displays his grace and love. Now, it's understandable why Queen Vashti refused to come into the presence of this king, Ahasuerus. Who would want to come into that banquet? But who could refuse such an incredible invitation from God to come into his presence? To refuse God's grace is the height of ingratitude, the height of thanklessness. There is no reason to resist the call of God to come, especially in light of what Jesus has done for his bride. King Ahasuerus objectified his bride in order to feed his pride and his pleasure. Jesus, on the other hand, gives his life for his bride, for us, died for our sin. And we respond not begrudgingly like Vashti, but out of absolute thankfulness and gladness that we have such a gracious king. Now, this sacrificial love is the model by which God establishes male headship in the home. God decrees that men should lead their homes, but in a vastly different way to that of King Ahasuerus. For men that follow Jesus, leading our families and churches is never done from a place of raw power or personal gain or personal pleasure. That's not leadership or headship at all. It's domination and manipulation and abuse. Male leadership in homes is established by the example of Jesus and his sacrificial love. Even to the point of death, we read in Ephesians chapter 5, "Wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord." And then verse 25, "Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her." Godly husbands don't abuse their wives. They sacrifice their lives for them. They consider their wives first to encourage them in their God-given gifts and aspirations. Well, who is your king? Will you settle down and get comfortable with the kingdom around you? Take on the traits of the kingdom, like the temptation of living in Persia. The power, the glory, the wealth, using others for your own gain. We see that those pursuits are ultimately empty. There's a better kingdom coming, one that provides lasting meaning and purpose, the kingdom that Jesus will establish himself. And unlike King Ahasuerus, there is true wisdom in God's law. And we can trust that unlike King Ahasuerus, God is absolutely sovereign. He is at work directing the circumstances of life for the good of his people. Amen. Well, let's spend some time in prayer. Janelle came up to me at the start of the service and said that she would like us to pray for the pastors at Camel Wheel, Thelma and Cyril Anderson, who have a grandson in hospital who's in critical condition. So we'll pray for him. And also for one of the ladies at the end of last service came up to me and said, asked for prayer for someone by the name of Damien Riley, who they knew was in Townsville as well, in a difficult condition as well. So we'll pray for those people. Let me pray. Well, Father, we've seen a lot in this passage, a passage that you seem strangely absent from, but yet you are actively at work directing the affairs of Ahasuerus and the advisors and the Queen Vashti, all for the good of your people and ultimately your glory. We are reminded in these verses not to build up our own empires, not to grasp for ourselves our own power, but to wait patiently for your kingdom to come. And we can be confident, even when you seem absent, that you are at work. May that be good news to us, this work, that you are at work in our lives. We ask that your hand of providence would be good news to those who are sick or struggling. We ask for the grandson of this pastor's family, that he might know your providence as you provide grace and peace and comfort. For Damien Riley is in Townsville as well, that you might provide the same. Would you remind them that you haven't forgotten them? We ask for your care and comfort would be with Margaret Burns. As Crystal, as we prayed for last week as well, as she goes to surgery in Townsville, please help us as a church family to be aware of how we can serve our family in times of need. Please help us be a good and godly witness to the community around us, and that you'll be pleased to draw many people to yourself through the ministry of this church. We ask that the missionaries we support would also be a bold witness to those they serve. We ask that there might be a suitable employment for Ben Bishop next year as he transitions into paramedics. We ask that you be gracious to our nation and provide rain, and that you provide wisdom to our government to rule according to your will. We ask these things for your glory. In Jesus Christ, amen. Good. Thank you, Naomi.